Development Committee, and I apologize for the delay. This is our last day to push out Senate bills, so there's been a lot that's been going on in the last 5-10 minutes since we've all been here on time, and I appreciate that. And remember, committee, we do meet again at 6 o'clock tonight. Let me tell you what is not going to be heard today. There are some issues still remaining with some of these bills, so I've just decided to pull them from the docket today. Senate Bill 213 will not be heard. Senate Bill 1029 will not be heard. Instead, colleagues, I'd like to write, there's been a lot of, do I have to go into work session to talk about that?
Why don't we do that?
Okay, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 1029. The reason we're not going to hear that bill today is there's a lot of anxiety among the university system folks, and they're rightly full of anxiety, but the students are especially full of anxiety. So I thought the better approach was that I would write a letter and hopefully the committee would sign it to the university system asking them to look into the issues that the students discussed and report back to us by mid-next month, so that if we don't see any movement on this bill, we will just stuff it into another bill that's relating to education and move it at that time. Is the committee okay with me doing that?
Sure. Me.
Yes. Okay. All right. Then that's what we will do, and I'll get the letter out to you probably tomorrow. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1029. We also will not be hearing Senate Bill 775. I know there were some folks on this committee who thought that was a good bill, but again, that has some problems that have not been resolved. I apologize if that's something that you were interested in. Okay, so Senator Carter is here, so we will take Senator Carter's bill first, and then we'll go into 378 so that Mr. Hendricks can get back to doing what he does best in the Legislative Council office. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 724.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 724 permits a person convicted of misdemeanor prostitution to be issued a teaching license or registration, personnel service, or administrative license by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission if the person is determined to be fit to be a teacher. Allows the school district to employ or contract with a person convicted of misdemeanor prostitution if the district determines the person is fit to be employed by or to contract with the district. You have dash twos in front of you. I couldn't tell you exactly where they are in your pile, but hopefully you've got them close at hand.
They're right on top, I think.
The dash two permits issuance of a license or registration or employment or contract with the district if the conviction of misdemeanor prostitution is more than 5 years prior to the date of application.
Okay. Senator Carter, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the hearing and work session this morning. My name is Margaret Carter, Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. Senate Bill 724, if anything, is about forgiveness. It would allow the TSPC in a case-by-case review, particularly for individuals who may have a misdemeanor violation at a young age. This came to my attention because there was a young man who had been in our office who was at Princeton University and who had had many and had some indiscretions in his youth, but now is a college professor and said that I can teach at the university system, but I can't teach in a high school. It also happened with some young people who had been on the job 13 to 15 years in Portland area, and someone came across their files and they were released from their jobs. I want to say, if anything, that there are three different cases regarding prostitution. One is misdemeanor, the other one is felony, and the other one is...
One is a Class C felony and one is a Class B.
State your name for the record, please.
John Christensen, staff, Senator Carter.
Thank you.
And so the one we're looking at, Madam Chair, is the misdemeanor. In the words of the TSPC, we've seen young people make career changes after they've turned their lives around. These people are often role models for wayward youth. We do not want to deny licensure or careers to individuals who can make a difference and are committed to education. The interesting thing about this, as I chair the Subcommittee on Human Services, I look at how this state does in terms of prevention, tertiary care, and how we try to allow people to redeem themselves on drug and alcohol, and all the issues surrounding those issues. And yet we are at a point where we are not willing to give young people who've changed their lives, who've gone to college and have really redeemed themselves, to give them a chance to teach school or to do other things in life. I think that that is a double standard. Often these individuals have been exploited themselves and subject to abuse at an age misdirected and used by persons who they trust. Behaviors that start often at 15 are wrapped in the downward spiral of chemical or substance abuse. Senate Bill 724, Madam Chair, members of the committee, says to a young woman or man, there can be a second chance. And it says to those who have reformed, rebuilt their lives, that you do not have to live in fear that one day you may not have to resign from your career from an indiscretion you made at age 15. This is an act of forgiveness. That's what 724 is all about. Our capacity as a society to forgive. Oregon is the only state on the West Coast that does not provide for a case-by-case review in these circumstances. California and Washington does. So does Nevada and Idaho. We can forgive, too, here in Oregon. Just like to quote something that I quote a lot, as the Lord's Prayer says, forgive us as we forgive those who trespass against us. We should have the capacity to forgive. Hence, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill is before you today. I ask for your consideration. And John Christensen, my staff, is here. We've been working on this bill for 3 years. This would be the second session that we've been working on this bill. So if there are technical questions that I can't answer, he's here for that purpose. So I'm open for questions.
Okay. Senator Carter, how is the bill different from last session? What do your amendments change?
The amendments change a five-year period of time. During the first time, we just had an act of forgiveness. But now, if there is a five-year period of time between when those actions at indiscretion took place, then we are asking TSPC and any other body to be able to look at that. And I think we spelled out the difference between those three different levels of prostitution as well.
Yes. In the material, John Christensen, staff for Senator Carter, in the materials that you have today, you have a copy of the statute that show the different violations with regard to prostitution. Senator Carter's bill only addresses a Class A misdemeanor. It does not address the Class B felony or the Class C felony. One of those is promoting prostitution and the other one is compelling prostitution. This would not apply to those individuals.
Okay. Okay. Any questions from the committee? Senator Carter, I remember this bill from last session, and this committee did support it last session, and
right.
I see that you've trimmed it down even more.
Right.
So I really appreciate what you're trying to do here. I'm surprised that we are the only state on the West Coast that doesn't do this on a case-by-case basis.
Right. Right.
And I'm thinking, too, that in the interim, if I do chair this committee or some education-related committee, I'd like to look at some of the reasons why we disqualify people from being a teacher and take a second look at some of those.
Exactly. And Madam Chair, there were, in Multnomah County, there were about three or four people who were let go, who were working with children as well. And I didn't know how, and I'm going to talk with some of the other attorneys, to see how this could be beyond schools, but as well to government. That same thing could possibly happen with the state of Oregon, mm-hmm. with our employees as a government. Mm-hmm. They still can do that. And so this one just happens to be dealing with schools at this particular time. But I did not know how to, I didn't have opportunity to see how we could work with it in terms of other institutions.
Okay.
Madam Chair, John Christensen for the record. There was a lady who contacted our office, Senator Carter's office, and Representative Kotek's office, a mother who had been convicted of a misdemeanor when she was younger, and she wanted to volunteer in her child's classroom, and she wasn't allowed to do so.
She wasn't even allowed to volunteer?
No, ma'am. And so some of these instances are coming forward, and Senator Carter wanted to address them. And with this initial first step.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee?
Well, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Wilson.
I have a burning question I'd like to ask Mr. Christensen.
Yes, sir.
That's of complete germaneness to this discussion.
Yes, sir.
As your questions always are.
Senator Carter, help me on this.
No, I think you are singularly able to answer this question, sir.
Okay.
Where did you get that gorgeous yachting picture behind your desk in your office? That's germane.
To something, I'm sure.
I'll find out for you, sir. There are a number of people in my family and also associations that have backgrounds in yachting on a national and international level. And that's where it comes from.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I know, Senator Cruz.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't even answer the question. I'm being nice. You know, I'm not indignant.
Yeah, thank you so very
probably
much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Member of the Committee.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 724. I'm going to open a work session on 724.
Madam Chair, I move the dash to amendment
Senator
to Senate Bill 724.
Senator Cruz moves the dash to amendment to Senate Bill 724. Any questions or discussion? Okay, hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 724 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 724 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any comments?
Madam Chair, I voted for it last session. I'll vote for it again this session.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. I appreciate
that. Why is that germane? The different bill.
Ms. Gravel, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye. Excuse me. Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 724 receives the constitutional majority. Senator Carter, are you carrying that, please? Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 724. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 378.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 378 applies statutes enacted after January 1, 1995 to the Oregon Health and Science University, hereafter known as OHSU, unless specifically exempted. It applies to statutes governing public bodies generally and enacted after October 6, 2001 to OHSU, and it excludes OHSU from participating in the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, declares an emergency, and would take effect July 1, 2007. You have dash 2 and dash 3s in front of you. I can speak to them. You can have Mr. Hendricks speak to them. Madam Chair.
Unfortunately, I didn't see. We can just have Mr. Hendricks speak to those. I'm not sure where these. One of these came from OHSU. Jack, are you responsible for the dash 2 or the dash 3? Where did the 3s come from? Mr. Hendricks? Did I ask for those and not remember? Okay. I'm not sure what the difference is, what they are. We'll let Mr. Hendricks discuss that in a second. Mr. Hendricks, the reason, and committee, the reason I drafted this bill is because I've had a very deep concern about OHSU on many levels that has spanned quite a discussion range. And there is a little-known statute that says that every time legislative council has a bill relating to public bodies, they have to make sure that OHSU is exempt. Is that correct, Mr. Hendricks? Why don't you explain?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Legislative Counsel's office. Not quite. It's close, though.
Close, but in no cigar.
Yeah, in 1995, there was a provision added to the OHSU laws that said that laws that were passed by the Legislative Assembly that applied to public bodies generally would not apply to OHSU unless OHSU was specifically mentioned. So,
and that was when OHSU became a public corporation.
Correct. It was part of that law that changed its status somewhat. So Senate Bill 378 would reverse that and essentially say, no, all of those laws did apply. It's a question, really, of what legislators think about when they pass laws that just generally say public bodies. You know, all public bodies shall do this. All public bodies shall not do that. And we do draft a lot of those bills. Currently, you know, we do not have usually the time or, and I'm not sure every single drafter would necessarily know this, to say, oh, I'd better ask them if they would like to have this law apply to OHSU, which is where we're at right now, because unless you specifically mention them, you do not pick them up. I should mention, too, the Oregon State Bar has a similar provision that goes much further back, I believe. I think that one goes back a lot further. Under Senate Bill 378, you would reverse that and basically put yourself back in to the same position that basically all of those laws that were passed since then that just talked about public bodies generally would apply. The Dash 3 amendments, and I think I'll address them because...
Oh, it's coming back to me now.
Yes. The Dash 3 amendments would have the same effect, except that it would only apply to laws enacted after January 1st, 2007, which means that under the Dash 3 laws, you'd have a gap period. Right now, we have a situation where laws enacted before 1995 that just talked about public bodies do apply to Oregon Health Sciences University. We have, since 1995, they don't. And under the Dash 3, starting again in 2007, laws enacted after that date and just talked about public bodies would. So that's the Dash 3 amendments. One other thing I would mention is the committee administrator indicated that the bill itself would prohibit OHSU from participating Oregon prescription, and they don't do that. Actually, the reason that we deleted on page 3 at line 32 of the bill, the reason we deleted the reference there is because we had added, you know, when we said, okay, Oregon Health and Science University isn't going to be exempted from these general definitions anymore, we had to decide where to put them, and under Section 3, we just said, okay, we're going to call them a special government body, which is an existing group of entities. And you'll notice on page 3, up at line 29, one of the entities able to participate in the program are special government bodies as defined in 174.117. So we kind of took them out of there, but they were already there underneath the change in the definition. So this does not affect OHSU participation in the drug program.
Okay. Well, we will correct that. It's easy to see how that was assumed. Okay. And the Oregon State Bar has the same problem. I think I'll draft another bill next session to address the state bar.
I believe there's maybe one other one that was added last session as well. You know, these become kind of models.
Mm-hmm.
When you become a public corporation, take these statutes, copy them in. And so I think there may have been one more last session that added this as well. So the question is really, you know, were these, once you have a declaration of public corporation, whether or not, you know, which way you want to go, which way the preference is. Do you want to say when you enact a law relating to public bodies generally, we don't want to talk about entities that have been declared to be public corporations, or do you think they should be referred to?
Senator Cruz, yeah, do you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Hendricks, is SAFE included or excluded currently?
SAFE is actually... SAFE, as I remember, does not have this type of language in their statute. One of the entities that we cover underneath special government body, and the reason I talk about special government bodies is we did this big project about three sessions back to try to come up with some consistent terminology to how we talk about public bodies. And the main thing was to do was trying to come up with a category of what is a public body versus a private. But within those categories, we said, well, let's also talk about what is state government. Let's talk about what is local government, because there were a lot of statutes that would talk about local government as though everybody knew what a local government was, and, of course, nobody knew what a local government was. I mean, was the school district a local government? You could make arguments. And so we came up with these categories, and we left with this kind of catch-all category, which we called special government bodies. And one of the things we put in there were public corporations created under statute of the state. And
so that would be SAFE.
SAFE.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So this just puts the onus back on OHSU to do their own darn research on bills that might apply to them, correct?
Chair Walker, I expect they already do that.
I expect they do that as well.
I expect they take a look at bills relating to public.
I'm sure they look at every single bill. I noticed that they found all the ones I've drafted.
By the way, I have to admit, I have to confess to an error, though, on the -3 amendments.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's an easy one, though, and maybe one that can be done on the run here. And it's hardly a fatal one. But on line 8 of the -3 amendments, it deletes 2001 and inserts 2007. Should actually read, delete October 6, 2001, and insert January 1st, 2007. And the reason for that is the question is, if you go with these amendments, laws passed this session would apply to OHSU if they just talked about public bodies. And you'll note the -2s would key it to January 1st, 2008, and consequently, laws passed this session would not apply. It would only be starting in 2009, special session, annual session, whatever
we're going to call that. I'm not quite sure yet if we have a name for that.
So anyway, I think that's something we can probably take care of if you decide to proceed with them.
Okay. We can either do it, depending on where my committee wants to go with this bill, we can either do it conceptually, or you can probably whip that up today and get us back to us tonight at our 6 o'clock meeting.
Easily could do that.
Would you prefer doing that than conceptual?
I think it's a good idea. Just not so we don't start establishing any precedents too early.
Well, there'll be enough of that as we move along. But, all right. Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. If you could just stick around for a few minutes while we hear from OHSU in case there is some questions that need answered. Mr. Steve Statham, I think that's how I read that. You didn't put down a position on this bill. Are you for, against, or neutral? State your name and then tell.
My name is Steve Statham. I'm Executive Vice President of OHSU. Good morning, Chair Walker, members of the committee. OHSU is not opposed to the bill, but we're not for the bill either. We're neutral.
So you're neutral.
Yes. We are mainly here to answer questions. Mr. Hendricks did a good job of summarizing the history. I would just add that I think the purpose of the provision, as I understand it, was that the legislature wanted to sort of impose some discipline on itself when creating a public corporation like the bar or OHSU to consciously decide which laws would apply to an organization that was intended to be created in a flexible operating manner. And I believe that was the intent. Also, just to clarify one thing Mr. Hendricks said, the charter or the public corporation bill for OHSU doesn't sweep every statute that existed before 1995 into application to OHSU. There's a specific list. It's a long list, but it isn't every single one. To our knowledge, there's no particular problem that has been identified, at least that we're aware of. We'd be happy to work further on any specific concerns or answer any questions.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. You review every single bill that comes out of this legislature, do you not?
We attempt to.
Okay. So you have to look at them anyway. If you have a concern, you're going to be right here addressing that concern, right?
Yes, we will. I think the difference is simply the balance between flexibility and ease of sweeping a public entity like OHSU into general bills and making sure that there isn't some inadvertent mandate or requirement that's imposed that the legislature might not intend. But yes, we look at them all.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 378. Mr. Hendricks, would you please redraft the amendment, and that will give me time to discuss with my committee, and we'll bring this back at 6 o'clock. Thank you. Okay. There are a lot of bills up here today.
Yes, you do.
All right, let's do the Canyonville bill.
Okay.
Is there any reason to do anything else?
It's fine. First.
Okay. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 462.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 462 divides the South Umpqua School District Number 19 into two districts under certain circumstances. It provides for distribution of property, assets, and liabilities to the newly created district and declares an emergency and will take effect upon passage. We have before us today dash ones and dash twos. I'm quite sure we'll talk about the dash twos. Shall I give a summary of that?
Sure.
The dash twos replace the measure. It requires the superintendent of public instruction to issue a fact-finding report on the division of the South Umpqua School District Number 19 on or before October 31st, 2007. It provides for the selection and duties of a designated fact-finder. It requires the report to order the district boundary board to submit the question of dividing the school district to the school district electors, or recommend conversion of the new school to a public charter school, or recommend alternative operation of the new school. Requires the district boundary board to proceed with division if the majority of votes cast in the election approve. It provides for the appointment of initial board members of the new district. It requires contributions for cost of administering the statute, and it declares an emergency and take effect upon passage.
Okay. Senator Cruz, who would you like to have come up and help explain these?
Just some random gentleman from the back of the room.
Okay. Well, do you think we've solved this problem?
Well, Madam Chair, my name is Chuck.
No,
Bennett.
But
we're down the road. Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Madam Chair, we'd reviewed the bill and listened to the testimony, And as has been said before, what we seem to have here was a real failure to communicate. And
very bad marriage.
And really heading toward the rocks, eh? And so we thought we would take a get together with some folks and take a look at how this could possibly be solved to the benefit of the children in the both potential school districts, and particularly the existing school district, and if there is a new Canyonville school district, and also meet the expectations of federal state law and the patrons of either one or both districts in terms of the economic viability and appropriate use of tax money. And we think that this amendment kind of meets those expectations. I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Green, if you'd like to. We can go through the amendment.
That would be great. I think the committee would appreciate understanding where we're going to go to help these folks out.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. And when we heard the testimony earlier this week, and I think it was you, Madam Chair, who said this looks like a divorce. Mm-hmm. One of the things in divorce court is you have mediation mm-hmm. before you get to the issue of a judge issuing an order on the irreconcilable differences. And that's what this is about. The Dash 2 amendments do that. It says the state superintendent shall pick a fact finder from the list of six folks that the two parties put before the state superintendent. We wanted it to be the superintendent comes up with six lists and the two parties pick from that list. Cindy Hunt down in legislative council, who is way smarter on this stuff than I am, said that's an unconstitutional delegation to a non-existent group because the Canyonville Schools Committee is not a governmental entity. So she caught that. Thank God for Cindy down in legislative council. Mm-hmm. And so what's going to happen is they will put together the names that go to the state superintendent of public instruction. The state superintendent of public instruction shall pick somebody, and the fact finder shall look at things. And you saw these in the dash ones, the division of the school district. And if that's going to occur, then you're going to look at the finances, the plan, the business plan, the facilities, all the things that you heard about the other day. The other thing they can look at is a charter school option for the Canyonville schools or any other alternative that's there. If, in fact, the fact finder makes the recommendation that, hey, there ought to be a separate school district, then they're going to refer it for an election of the affected electors of the school district down there. And that would go to the boundary board. And in the instances of these issues, the boundary board is the ESD, the Douglas ESD. So I think what you're going to see is, and this has to be done by October 31st of this year, and the cost for that fact-finding, because the Department of Ed would probably find a fiscal analysis on this that would blow this thing out of the water, the cost for this is going to be paid by both parties. And I think we have agreement from both sides. I know at least from the school district side, they're willing to do that. And I think John Osborne, who you heard from earlier, is the legal counsel for these folks, has in concept said yeah, and he could come up at any time and shake his head or say no or, you know, whatever. But I think this is the process that will get us to actually looking at facts, actually looking at dollars, actually looking at facilities and viability and what the impact is on not only Canyonville, but what may be the surviving South Umpqua School District if there's a division. I think it really does get to the issue of, you know, these parties have not had great discussions, and now you're going to bring in a neutral third party from a list that they both put together to come in and say, let's really take a look at this and let's get it down on paper. The recommendation will be given to the state superintendent, and then we'll see what happens with that.
Okay. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Ms. Chair, I'd just like Mr. Osborne to come up and opine
okay.
as well.
John Osborne, attorney for the Canyonville School Committee. We have not seen the language specifically, but as Jim and Chuck have explained it to us, we think this is an appropriate disposition, and we appreciate the effort that the committee and Senator Cruz have put into this to get this to a decision that makes sense for everybody.
Thank you. We're in work session, correct?
We're in work session.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that that we would have Cindy Hunt has done yeoman's work on this, considering the workload that she has at this point during the session, and I really appreciate her work. And it would, you know, we have attempted to get the amendments out as quickly as we had them. We didn't get them until last night. So I mean, you know, it was 5 o'clock or something like that when I first saw them. So, but I'd also like to say that I do think it's frustrating to me looking at this issue on the front end of the fact that there is provision in law for combining districts, no provision in law for separating districts. And so what it has come down to historically is the legislature basically saying split or no. And I'm not sure that the legislature is necessarily the appropriate venue for that. I think what we have set up in this bill and is a template that will serve us going out into the future if this issue comes up in any other jurisdiction. I know the Canyonville folks on the front end just wanted to separate, and I respect that wish. But I also think that the very best we can do is to make sure that all facts are on the table and that we're doing something that's true and appropriate, especially appropriate for the kids involved. This gives everybody their day in court.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets down to a decision of the electorate based on facts. And I think for all considered, that is probably the best solution. It's not going to mean that everybody's going to be happy with the outcome, but at least everybody will be at the table, and that is something that hasn't happened to date. So, and I would also point out that that the bill as originally drafted probably would not have survived to go to the governor's desk. I believe this has a very high likelihood of making it through the process. So, with that, Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 2 Amendment to Senate Bill 462.
Great. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 Amendment to Senate Bill 462. Any further discussion in the committee? I do want to compliment you, Senator Cruz, and all the parties here and the folks who came up from Canyonville. It clearly became obvious that this was a case that needed mediation. We have court-mandated mediation in divorce cases, and this seemed like the way to go. I didn't want to hear this bill. I mean, I was not going to get in the middle of this because there just seemed to be not a good answer and a good outcome. And people kept writing to me, and so I took a second look, talked with Senator Cruz, and I said, make it work. And he did, and I'm really impressed. You've done a good job for your district, and I just really want to commend
you.
Well,
it's interesting, Madam Chair, the certified smart people in politics told me that I was a fool to get involved in this, so because I was going to piss people off on both sides. but what I saw was an untenable situation that needed to be resolved, and my hope was that we could come up with a way to resolve the situation. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, politics be damned, I want good outcomes.
Yeah, and what I thought was good yesterday, or Tuesday, that came out in the testimony was the district didn't really save money by doing what they did. They actually spent more.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that would have come out had we not had our day in court. So I do appreciate that. Hearing no further discussion, the Dash 2s are adopted.
I'm trying to move Senate Bill 462 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 462 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Ms. Gravel?
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Lesman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Senate Bill 462 passes, and Senator Cruz, you're carrying that.
I had a feeling that.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Okay.
Your moment, Mrs. is not germane to you. That's true.
729 or 929. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Let's do 779. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 779.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 779 requires school districts to establish a complaint process, allows an appeal to the superintendent of public instruction if the school district process is not followed, declares an emergency, and take effect July 1st, 2007. Before us, we have Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. When we first heard this bill, we had the Dash 1s before us, but not the Dash 2s. And I suspect that we'll focus today's discussion on the Dash 2s. Shall I explain those?
Sure.
The Dash 2s replace the measure. It requires the State Board of Education to adopt rules for a school district complaint process. It requires the process to include specific timelines for completing the complaint process and rendering a final decision. It permits appeal of the final decision to a superintendent. It declares an emergency and take effect July 1st, 2007.
Okay. Senator Metzger, you were on this little work group, were you not?
Actually, my staff, Becca, was and did an excellent job of meeting with parties there, and I think they can discuss that, Mr. Bennett and Mr. Green. And
okay.
And that's what produced the Dash 2.
Great. And Margaret DeLacy, did you want to come forward, too?
Madam Chair, if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. All right. Mr. Bennett, why don't you explain away?
Madam Chair, I wasn't able to grab a copy if there's one just available today.
Here you go.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, just to underscore Senator Metzger's comments regarding his staff member, Becca. She, again, this is the second time I've had a chance to work with her, and she really does do a very good job. She's quite good at working with us on some of these very divisive issues. Madam Chair, this is a pretty straightforward request regarding adoption of some complaint procedures at the state level required upon school districts. We have no problem with the amendment. The only thing I would ask you on this one, there is a complaint process that is working its way through right now. Rules being adopted by the state board, they're set for hearing in May. That'll set up really the rules that are contemplated in this amendment. And the only concern I would have is that this bill may not make it to the governor's desk before the rules are actually adopted. It would be unfortunate if there was any confusion at the State Department level regarding this bill, those rules, and the application of those rules to this bill. I mean, you wouldn't want to derail a process that's in place by passing a bill. So if that's just real clear, that makes it just all that much better. What you'll probably have is rules in place before you have a statute in place requiring the rules to be adopted.
Okay.
But that's okay. You know, that's okay with us if it's okay with you.
All right. Who okay. from the department worked on your work group? Was it Mr. Harnish? Mr. Harnish, can you come on up? Is the child in the back related to you?
Take your daughter to work day.
Oh. What is your daughter's name?
Emma.
Emma, would you like Emma to come up and be with you this morning?
If
Emma, come on up. It's take your daughter to work day.
I warned her.
This is the education committee. So.
Oh, you're a beautiful young lady. Will you introduce yourself on the record for us?
I'm Emma.
Harnish.
And how old are you, Emma?
11.
So, fifth or sixth grade?
Fifth.
What school do you go to?
Myers.
In Salem? Well, great. Well, welcome to the committee today. You can see what your daddy does. So, Mr. Harnish,
yes.
Can you talk to us about your rulemaking process? Was this something you were doing anyway or because of this bill? And is this going to all interfere or overlap?
I think it's going to overlap. It's Randy Harnish with the Department of Ed. It's going to overlap, but it really does mesh quite nicely. We were underway in looking at our appeals and complaints process and have rules filed with the Secretary of State. They will be going to the board for a first read next month, and if all goes well, we should have them adopted in June. And they really accomplish much of what would be called for in the bill in establishing or requiring districts to have a complaint process that lays out time periods and then I think better defines how that complaint would come to the department and what it would look like in the appeal process when if it comes to the superintendent's office.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you don't see this bill as an impediment? Do you see it as unnecessary or just...
I think it accomplishes... It simultaneously accomplishes the same thing. I think
right.
by...
It's a race to the finish line?
Passing by passing the bill, it very clearly gives us the direction to do what we're what we're currently doing. So it's really, I guess it's really up to you to decide if that's something that's necessary. We have no reason to believe that we won't complete the process. It might not happen exactly in June, but it's certainly something that's in our work plan for the next couple of months.
Okay. Well, Senator Metzger, what do you think?
I would say, I think the issue has been articulated well. This does parallel the way the language is at the dash two. Tells them to do what they're doing and sets a parameter for an appeal, which they're working on, which is a good thing. I think from a confidence level, and I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I think the timeline actually does parallel very well with keeping the bill moving at this point, and there may be a point in which, before the process is over, it's not necessary, but to the extent that it ensures that the process continue, I think that's a confidence level that the parties might find valuable at the moment.
I I would agree. I really took to heart these parents who get labeled as problem parents only when they're trying to do make the education system work the way it's supposed to. And I think they deserve their stamp on a bill, and I'm going to give it to them.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 779.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 779. Any further discussion? Hearing none, so order.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 779 as amended to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 779 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? I want to thank all of the parties that participated in this, and thank you, Emma. We appreciate you being here today. Would you take the roll, Ms. Gravel?
Emma, what do you think? Should we vote yes or no? What do you think? Yes, aye. Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator Webster?
Aye.
Vice
aye.
Hi, Senate Bill 779.
I bet you're going to carry this. Right?
No, I'm actually giving this to Senator Metzger since he worked so hard on
okay.
it.
Okay.
Actually, again, I didn't, but Becca Feathers did, and I. And that's what a tag. When you have a tag person in your office, they get stuff done.
That's right. That's right. All right. The bill passes, and Senator Metzger will carry it, and Ms. Feathers, I hope, will be on the floor as you do so. Okay, let's go on to. Do you want to do 822?
Sure.
Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 822.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 822 revises the process for giving veterans and disabled veterans preference in civil service employment and promotion. It requires the public employer to appoint a veteran or disabled veteran to a vacant position if the results of an application examination are equal to or higher than other applicants. It allows a veteran or disabled veteran to use the preference more than once. Requires a written explanation be provided to a veteran or disabled veteran that is given preference but not appointed to a vacant position. It specifies that failure to give a veteran or disabled veteran preference in promotion is an unlawful employment practice with the right of appeal to the Bureau of Labor and Industry. Allows a civil action for failure to comply with the preference requirements, declares an emergency, and would take effect upon passage. We have before us today Dash 1 and Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments. My sense is that the committee would be most interested in the Dash 1s and the Dash 3s. Can I briefly explain those?
Sure, because I have a Dash 2 here also.
The Dash 1s were before us last time. They clarified the definition of a veteran who served on active duty. The Dash 3 amendments are the same as the Dash 2s. So maybe I should explain the Dash 2s. I'll go back and do that. The Dash 2s require the public employer to grant a preference to veteran or disabled veterans who successfully complete the hiring process or a civil service test. They allow the veteran or disabled veteran to request a written explanation if not appointed to a vacant position, and they add meeting minimum and special qualifications to qualify for preference and promotion. The Dash 3s, similar, but clarify that the public employer shall grant preference to a veteran or disabled veteran who successfully completes the initial application screening, the application examination, or the civil service test.
Okay. Sasha, did you want to come up and address these?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work for Senator Ryan Deckard's office. We drafted the Dash 2 amendments after concerns from the Department of Administrative Services on how they would enact this rule. It was clarification for them. All of the parties that were involved in the drafting of the original bill are pleased with the outcome. We think it's a stronger bill, and the clarifications help it to allow us to move forward and allow this actually to work for veterans in the process of hiring.
Okay.
Confusion, Madam Chair.
Confusion, all right. Let's see.
Because Dana said she thought we'd be interested in the threes, and you spoke to the twos.
The Dash 3s had one more clarification that was brought up yesterday that was simply clarifying the very beginning about the civil service test, the very beginning of how a veteran gets into the hiring process. The language was unclear, and that was an additional clarification. Everything else in the Dash 3s is exactly like the Dash 2.
Right. I just wanted you to speak to
absolutely.
The 3s.
Thank
so.
You. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Great. Any other questions, Ms. Pollack? I love this bill. remember these sweet little veterans, not so little, but they were sweet. They were, I just loved their testimony, and I remember this one, we must, they quoted the governor, we must not pay repay real service with lip service. So I think we're meeting that today, don't you?
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I move the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 822.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 822. Any discussion? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 Amendment to Senate Bill 822.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 3 Amendment to Senate Bill 822. Any further discussion? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 822 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 822 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further conversation about this?
Well, Madam Chair,
a few conversation with Chain.
Yeah, yes. I was a yes, and after I talked with Chain, no discussion.
Okay. All right. Hearing none, can you call the roll, Ms. Brown?
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 822 passes, goes to the floor, and I'll have Senator Deckert carry that. And I want to thank all of the folks who came and testified on this bill. All righty.
Thank you.
What's the procedure? 928? Okay, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 928.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 928 creates the Oregon Public Interest Professional Loan Repayment Program that would be administered by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. It allows the commission to enter into agreements with individuals employed in specified areas for repayment of educational loans. It appropriates monies, declares an emergency, and take effect July 1st, 2007. We have before us today Dash 1 amendments that address the blank on page 2, line 10. The Dash 1 amendments require the loan recipient serve at least 3 years as a public interest attorney, teacher, or social worker. It raises the annual gross income from eligible employment to a $55,000 maximum. It appropriates $700,000 from the general fund for the loan repayment program, and the bill itself has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Mr. Manton, do you need to add anything to that? Okay. Committee, do you have any... Can I get a motion?
Madam Chair, you absolutely can. I move the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 928.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 Amendment to Senate Bill 928. Any discussion about that? I think that answers the questions that were raised.
Madam Chair, it does, and I want to thank the drafter and for making that accommodation. So.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the testimony on this bill. I just think it's a great idea, and I hope we can find the funding for it. Okay, no objection. Dash 1 is so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 928 as amended to the Full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 928 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. And that was a prior reference,
Well, it's got some money in it, so.
Yeah. Any objection? Hearing none, we'll just so order that one and send it off to Ways and Means. Good luck, Mr. Manton.
Yeah, you're going to need it, buddy.
Oh.
In your dreams.
Okay.
Oh, wait, I'm on the bill. It's good bill.
All right, let's see. You know, I think you guys might... I have some time this morning. We took some stuff off, and so we've got ourselves moving right along. What would you like to do next?
I'm going
to
let you decide.
614? Sounds good. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 614.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 614 establishes the minimum amount of cash on hand for nonprofit healthcare institutions or nonprofit providers of healthcare facilities that they must have before the Oregon Facilities Authority or Hospital Authority may provide bond proceeds. It requires the healthcare institution to have certificate of need to qualify for public financing. It exempts rural hospitals. It requires the Oregon Facilities Authority board members to declare actual or potential conflicts of interest based on relationships with a nonprofit corporation. It requires a member of a hospital authority board of directors to declare an actual or potential conflict of interest based on the relationship with a nonprofit corporation and file a statement of economic interest.
We have before us today dash ones and dash twos. We had the dash ones before us last time we heard the bill. What's your pleasure, Madam Chair? Dash twos, probably?
Ms. Leonard, are you in the room?
Who's speaking to these?
I don't know. I'm so confused about ones and twos and threes and twelves and nines, and we got so many amendments. So,
Mayor Walker, members of the committee, Lynn Marie Kreider from SEIU. I am confused too, but not on this.
Okay.
What we want to look at is the dash twos.
Okay.
Which narrow the bill a great deal so that they focus exclusively on the municipally created healthcare finance authorities and would retain those provisions of the original bill that required the members of those authorities to file economic interest statements and to and would subject them to the requirements of the conflict of interest provisions of the statutes if they are a member of the board of directors of a hospital that's coming before the agency for requesting issuance of bonds. So it will be limited in that way.
Yeah, that's about all we do. We've taken out all the certificate of need stuff that was causing people angst.
That is correct, Chair Walker.
Okay. Committee, do you have any questions of Ms. Kreider about these amendments? Senator Morse, I know you don't think you were so jazzed about doing this, but maybe you've changed your mind.
Yeah, well, not really excited about it, but I'm curious what the hospitals
think about it. Okay. I'd be happy to do that at your request. So could someone from the hospitals please come up and join Ms. Kreider at the dais?
You seem like you're just
yeah, pretty much.
Two to one.
It's still not fair, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think it would, Kevin Earls, representing the Hospital Association, I'd like to defer my comments to follow Mr. Ork's or Mr. Goh's comments, if I may.
Okay. If you'll need a microphone, sir.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Douglas Goh. I am a partner in the law firm of Orrick, Harrington, Sutcliffe at 1125 Northwest Cooch in Portland, and I have the I'm a bond lawyer, work with many state agencies and with local governments around the state. In addition, I serve as special counsel and bond counsel to most of the hospital authorities in the state. And first of all, I want to commend the bulk of the amendments made in Dash 2 and taking out the bulk of the bill, certainly our authorities around the state. I just came from the Salem Hospital Authority meeting this morning, and the authorities are very much against Senate Bill 614. With respect to
the original form.
In its original form.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to the retaining the conflict of interest provisions and the disclosure provisions, I think that the feeling is that there's not that current law is sufficient to address those issues. Under the existing hospital authority statute, each members of the board of the authority, there must be at least one member of the governing body of the city or county or health district that created the authority. In some cases, as was testified at the last hearing, such as Multnomah County, the Board of Commissioners serves as the board of the authority. In the case of Salem, for example, two of the city council members are members of the authority. As a matter, our understanding of current Oregon law and what we advise authority members is that if in most cases there is not, the members of the authority are not members of the board or employed by the hospital or the senior living facility that comes in front of the authority. In those cases where they are, they cannot participate in voting and taking action on that bond issue. So in terms of these are, other than the members of the governing body, by and large, they're citizen members, leading members of the community who serve on these hospital authorities, and to impose another layer on them may inhibit the number of good authority members that you can recruit. Again, is there overwhelming opposition to, from a policy perspective, from the conceptual flavor, I think, of the disclosure and conflict of interest? No, because that's, in fact, how people operate currently. But the position of the authorities would be, it's on current law is satisfactory to address those issues. So we would urge that the Senate bill, the dash two amendments would be appropriate, but we would, other than we would delete the entire provisions. I think if you were to retain anything, I would say in terms of having them file the annual disclosure statement, I don't think would be a huge imposition on the members of the authority. But again, in general, we think that existing law is adequate to address the policy that's reflected in the dash two amendments.
Okay. I'd like a response from Ms. Kreider. Mr. Earls, I'm not sure you can add anything at this point.
Chair Walker. Members of the committee, we believe that state law does not require the recusal that apparently council recommends and that we have certainly seen in some cases, and we think it's better for state law to require that. And it certainly would be an improvement for us to know who the members of these bodies are and what their economic interests are. So I think that's the improvement that you will see as a result of passage of the bill as amended with the dash twos.
Mm-hmm.
Can I address that, Chair Walker?
Pressing the limit here.
The records of hospital authorities are public records. The members of the authority is public record. So in terms of knowing who the members are, that is absolutely public record. We have had the various authorities around the state a number of public information records requests over the last several years from various organizations, and including various unions, and we have fully cooperated with those records requests. So it's the records are an open book.
Okay. Well, I don't think people should have to do a public records request, and I have to file a statement of economic interest, and I don't see why you folks can't do it either. Senator Morris, did you get your questions answered?
Yeah, I do. Appreciate the testimony. I need to dash down to Ways and Means and testify on an electronic waste bill that I work with Representative Dingfelder on.
Okay. We're in work session.
Uh-huh.
Do you want me to just go at ease at this moment?
I would like to see this through. Number one, I think I need to declare a conflict of interest because I do serve in hospital governance.
Mm-hmm.
And have had that role for quite a number of years. This bill would require directors of these 501c organizations to file statements of economic interest, as do the public bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that really makes a whole lot of difference other than to create another possible obstacle to people that want to serve in these capacities.
we are required in my role, and I don't think we're a 501c, we're not a public hospital, but we have to file disclosure statements regarding conflicts of interest, and we do that annually. And I don't know what is required in current law with the bodies that we're talking about here, but I just don't see this as a necessary piece of legislation at this point.
Okay.
So,
What I can do, Senator Morse, is we're waiting on amendments for the last bill of the morning. Mm-hmm. So let's just stand at ease. That gives you a chance to run down and do your testimony, right, and then we'll come back, and then we'll continue in work session on this bill.
Thank you.
Okay? We're at ease. Thank you.
Thank you.
Committee will come back to order, and Senator Morse has gone and done good things in the building, and now he's back. And we are in work session on Senate Bill 614. I'd like Ms. Kreider to come up and clarify something for us, please. Lynn? When we went off the record, there was a question that came up when you made that comment about recusal. So could you explain that a little more deeply for us, please, what you meant by that?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, what the bill as amended does is to has to be read in tandem with Chapter 244, which defines actual and potential conflicts of interests and describes what a person, a public official with an actual or potential conflict of interest must do in certain circumstances. What 244 now does is say that a relationship that would create an actual or potential conflict of interest generally does not create a conflict of interest if one's position is a board of directors of a hospital, a member of a board of directors of a hospital. What this bill does is say, in the case of municipally created hospital facilities authorities, notwithstanding 244, a position as a board of direct, a person who is both a member of a facilities authority and a member of the board of a hospital, there can be an actual or potential conflict of interest, and if there is, one does what 244 would require of a person with a conflict of interest. So the rules about when one must recuse oneself from voting or participating in a discussion are actually in 244 rather than in this bill.
Okay, and in 244, the nonprofits are exempt from that provision. Of being
that
able
is
to
correct.
Recuse that themselves.
Being both a member of a public or a public official and a board member of a nonprofit, you would never have a conflict of interest under 244 as it stands.
And this changes.
This
that.
Changes that.
And says that you do.
Way. That's correct.
Okay, Senator Metzger, does that answer your question
mm-hmm.
that came up?
It does.
Okay, Senator Morse, you went and grabbed the statutes. Does that generate a question for you?
Understand.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
While he's looking, I'd like a medical dispensation to be excused from the committee, please. Ellen Lowe is in the back row. Absolutely traumatizing me with these outrageously but unfortunately true stories about how the San Francisco Giants pummeled my Dodgers. And I'm just feeling ill.
well, Senator, you're just going to have to suck it up and stay right where you are.
You're going to have to take it from Ellen. Yeah, okay.
Right. Madam Chair, I would say that any Dodger fan needs to be prepared to be ill most of the time.
Great comeback, Senator Cruz. All right, Senator Morris?
Well, maybe just by virtue of, so I can understand it better, and excuse me for being slow,
but all right.
The 244, under the policy section, the Legislative Assembly recognizes that it is the policy of the state to have serving on many state and local boards and commissions state and local officials who may have potentially conflicting public responsibilities by virtue of their positions as public officials and also as members of the boards and commissions, and declares it to be the policy of the state that the holding of such offices does not constitute the holding of incompatible offices unless expressly stated in the enabling legislation. Then it goes on to list the definitions of conflicts. Now, how does this bill relate to this statute? And if you could explain again what it does.
Well, at Chair Walker, Senator Morse, what is an actual and potential conflict of interest is defined in Chapter 244, 0.020 and sub 14C, okay. Sub 14, I believe, has the definition of a potential conflict of interest, if I recall correctly. You're looking at it. I'm not. But I believe that 020 sub 14 defines potential conflict of interest. And sub C of that section says it is not a conflict of interest if you are a member of a board of directors of a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Am I correct?
Just one correction. 14 sub C is membership in or membership on the board of directors of a nonprofit corporation that is tax exempt under 501c of the Internal Revenue Code.
So what this bill does, Senator Morse and Chair Walker, is to say that notwithstanding that exception, if you are serving on a hospital facilities authority, that relationship with a 501c3 corporation may create a conflict of interest.
I think if I'm right, Madam Chair, just to be clear, what it does, Senator Morris, as I understand it, if I'm wrong, is that this is an amendment to ORS 441540. So it doesn't change the conflict requirements for everybody who's a director of any nonprofit. Only if they're a director, a member of the 441540, which is the facilities authority. If they're on that, then the exception is not allowed because they're dealing with funds and potential public funds.
Thank you, Chair Walker. Senator Metzger, that's correct.
Sir?
Mr. Walker,
Gow? Just being on your board.
Microphone.
Vice Chair Cruz.
You need the microphone, sir.
On his board.
Pardon me. Chair Walker, Vice Chair
identify
Cruz.
Yourself again.
I'm sorry. Doug Gow with Orrick Harrington, for the record. I would ask the chair and the committee if we could, because this bill is amending Chapter 244, which, as you know, is also being amended, and I don't think the provisions of the Dash 2 amendments have caught up with the amendments to 244, and I'd like to be able to work with Ms. Kreider and her group to make sure that I think in terms of the intent of what she's looking for, I don't think we have a problem with, and would like to be able to work with Ms. Kreider and Legislative Council to come up with language that reaches the intended purpose. I would note on page 2, line 3 of the Dash 2 amendments, it talks about a director's relationship with a nonprofit corporation. It does not indicate
There is no reference to whether that nonprofit corporation, that could be any nonprofit corporation. I think the intent would be that it would be the nonprofit corporation who is coming in front of the authority to borrow money. But it's those sort of ambiguities that I think we should go ahead and address now and make sure that we also line up with Chapter 244 so there aren't unintended consequences of the bill. But in terms of the essence, I think, of what Ms. Kreider is after, we're comfortable with those because, again, as I indicated before, we think it is already reflective in existing law.
Ms. Kreider?
Chair Walker, if I may. I think that we would ask that the committee go ahead. We believe that it's, although the reference is only to nonprofits, because it's an exception to an exception, the existing law in 244 is what defines the association that creates the conflict of interest. And you're simply saying the exception that exists for nonprofits doesn't apply in this particular case. So I think it's clear. We would be happy to work with Mr. Goh in terms of looking at the other bill that is dealing with Chapter 244 and monitor that progress. But I do not know. It is not enacted into law, so I don't think we treat it in this committee as if it were.
Ms. Kreider, where is that other bill that you're referencing?
Madam Chair, I don't know where it is right now.
Do we have a bill number? Is it a Senate bill, a House bill? What are we talking about?
Nobody knows. Well, Madam Chair.
It's a law commission bill, but I don't.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yeah,
well, I would like to ask a question. Your comment was that this doesn't reflect catching up to the changes that are that may happen in 244, but I'm not an expert on all this, although I've seen most of those bills. I want to know what is the changes in 244 that would be potentially conflicting. Because we're only talking about the conflict of interest changes and the filing of the reports, but what do you see as moving through the process that has a conflict in 244? I haven't seen anything on that changes the conflict of interest statutes.
Chair Walker, Senator Metzger, in terms of the specific, since I don't have 244 in front of me, when you took a break, someone did show it to me, and I could see that there were conflicts between some of the provisions. Just again, as normally happens in the legislative process, there are amendments to that bill, and there are references, numbers, and so forth. I just want to make sure that so I don't have anything specific, Senator. Again, with respect to what you do have in front of you, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't cure an ambiguity in the bill in front of you, and instead of having an open-ended nonprofit corporation, make reference to the borrower that's coming in front of the hospital authority under Chapter 441-525.
Ms. Richardson, you walked into the room. You want to come up and join us here?
For the record, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff of the State Treasurer's Office. I just wanted to answer the committee's question. There was a question about the bill that was in process and what the change was.
Mm-hmm.
It's Senate Bill 494. It's one of the Oregon Law Commission's ethics bills. It's scheduled for tomorrow, I believe. But the change, and that's what I think we had discussed this also when the bill also was applying to the Oregon Facilities Authority. The change that the Law Commission took to this was actually to remove that exception entirely, not just for facilities authorities, but for all entities. And at the time when this bill, 614, applied also to the facilities authorities, that was our recommendation to proponents, was to use the same treatment that the Law Commission had come up with to address this issue. Not that we were, with the policy, we did not have an issue with the policy, but we wanted the treatment of it to be the same so that the change happened in 244, not an outlier out in the facilities authority statute.
Well, we can address that in a conflict amendment, yeah. It seems to me, on the House
right.
side.
I,
No, it had nothing to do with whether this bill passed or not. It was that the treatment be the same so that all conflicts of interest statutes applied to 244 so someone could look to 244. And the way it's treated, the language is much more clear. It doesn't use vague terms such as relationship. It made clear that just removing that exception and that that exception was limited to the interaction between the entity. So I'm just here to answer that question since I heard it come up. I grabbed the bill and gave it.
I'm glad you're watching on television.
I'm sorry, we're hearing that bill in Senate Judiciary tomorrow, you said?
It's in the Senate committee, and offhand, it's on my calendar. I can't remember exactly which committee, but it is, I think, scheduled for tomorrow.
Okay. Senator Metzger?
So just so I understand this clearly, what you're saying is the bill that's being heard has essentially this and everybody else, too.
Absolutely. And it's the treatment, and for us it was the treatment, the way it was written here, would have been a good option, we think, for being clear in law, and it would contain that in Chapter 244, which is the conflict of interest statute.
Well, can I make a comment, Madam Chair? Keeping in mind also we have our 6 o'clock meeting. I mean, if there's word changes you want to make, but as we all know, there's lots of bills in the process never make it through. So just because there's a bill out there doesn't necessarily mean anything's going to happen. And so I think that whether we do this right now and keep it moving, which I would support, or asking for some clarifying language if at this point, and I don't think it's necessarily required, but if you'd like, we do have a 6 o'clock meeting. If somebody wants to take a little different work on some of the language that has been mentioned, I think that is fine, too. But I would say that it would be, I wouldn't want to rely on another bill that may or may not go anywhere. And there are certainly conflict amendments. Legislative Council will always do at the end of session. You know, they're renaming the commission and everything else, but they take care of those conflicts.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, and again, we don't intend to rely on this bill. It was just this is model language that had been developed and addressed that issue to remove those ambiguities.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Richardson.
I'm hearing in the Senate committee tomorrow. I wasn't aware. Are there some Senate committees meeting tomorrow?
On Friday? No. Well, I don't know what Ways and Means is.
Well, I know that. It wouldn't be there.
No. But that doesn't really matter.
Well,
other than you're confused about when this bill is being heard.
Well, I was confused about the other bill and how it could be being heard tomorrow in a committee when I'm not aware of Senate committees meeting tomorrow.
Well, maybe Ms. Richardson may be wrong on the date. That's I'm sure.
They used to have hearings like that in the Senate in the days gone by when the chair would just have a meeting all by himself. But that was before
I remember those days.
Before it was on camera, I believe. So.
Senator Westland, you had a comment?
I think I understand the discussion, and I appreciate it. I think it's very legitimate to this issue. But what I'm concerned about here is that we actually have what I think, is, a bill greatly narrowed. I think, as you will recall, I had some problems with the original bill. I think there's been a very good faith effort to address an issue that, depending on your perspective, may or may not be legitimate. I happen to think this is a legitimate issue and a step forward in a process to add transparency to an area that is becoming increasingly contentious, not only in the legislative arena, but also in the public's eye. And so anything we can do, I think, to add a layer, even if it's redundant and maybe not the clearest language, is a step in the right direction, as has been indicated here. Make the assumption we pass this today. There are mechanisms for conflict amendments or clarifications on the House side. So I would encourage us to go forward, try to pass this bill, and see what happens legitimately in other committees at whatever time. I think that would be the most prudent course of action.
Mr. Crowe?
Just
just a point of information for Vice Chair Cruz, and the schedule indicates Senate Bill 494 will be heard by Senate Rules tomorrow at 1 p.m.
That's the one committee.
You're off the hook, Kate. So
he can read, you can't.
All right, thank you. Any other questions of these folks? All right, thank you both. I appreciate your helping us solve this problem. Senator Cruz, do you feel comfortable, or should I ask someone else to do it?
Madam Chair, I will move the Dash 2 amendment, Senate Bill 614, because it does make it a better bill.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 614. Any further discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 614 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation with the caveat that I'm going to vote against it.
Okay. I appreciate your service, Senator Cruz.
Does that mean he carries the bill?
No, that was a special circumstance.
Not this time. All right. Senator Cruz, in his duty as vice chair, moves Senate Bill 614 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. So further comments? Senator Metzger.
Just one final comment. I think this is a good approach, and I would just mention to those commenting on the bill and appreciating their comments that just a reminder of what this bill was when we started with it, and it was kind of teetering on passage in one way or another, and I think that this is probably a good outcome and would hope that they would support that.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. I couldn't agree with you more. Senator Morris, any comments?
Well, I'm just going back to the need issue, and I would refer to the testimony that I think brought this need forward. In addition, although an association with a for-profit business would create a conflict of interest for a public official addressing a request for public action by that business, the statutes provide that a member of the board of directors of a nonprofit hospital may act on a multimillion-dollar bond application by the hospital without regard to the conflict of interest provisions of state ethics law. And I think the testimony has been that we have current statutes in place that do address conflicts of interest, and I believe they do exist. But in light of, I think, disclosure, I don't think the bill is necessary, I'll be an aye vote.
Okay, I appreciate that. And we've noted your potential conflict of interest on the record earlier. Any other comments? All right, Ms. Gravel, would you take the roll, please?
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. Senate Bill 614 has the majority to pass. It will go to the Senate floor, and I will carry that. We will close the work session.
When do I get to carry a bill, Madam Chair?
Not everyone is as skilled at you as you about doing that, Senator Westland. Or as foolish, should I say.
Yeah.
All right, we've saved the one of the more difficult bills for last. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 365.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 365 directs publishers of college textbooks to provide prospective purchasers complete list of publishers' products, the wholesale price of each product, and the estimated length of time the publisher intends to keep the product on the market. Requires any person selling textbook bundles to a public higher education institution to offer the option of purchasing the bundle component separately. Requires any person selling textbook bundles to disclose to end users in all communications regarding the purchase of an individual textbook information on the availability and cost of the textbook if purchased separately. The bill would apply to textbooks purchased on or after the effective date of the act. We have before us today Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 3 amendments. Madam Chair, I think it'd be best probably to go through all three. What's your...
Well, I'd like to work with just the Dash 3s and the Dash 2s.
Okay. The Dash 2s replace the measure. The bill or the amendment changes the definition of a textbook bundle. provides that a textbook bundle does not include materials sold as an integrated combination of two or more units. It does not include materials that cannot be sold separately due to third-party contractual agreements. It does not include custom editions or special editions. The Dash 2 amendments require that a publisher selling textbook bundles to a public higher education institution to offer the option of purchasing a bundle component separately. It requires the publisher to, upon request, provide the price information of textbook bundle components to the higher education institution. Prohibits the higher education institution employee from receiving consideration for adopting specific required course materials. It provides exceptions to that. Prohibits the resale of textbooks or other materials identified as free review course materials. The Dash 3 amendments replace the measure. They have a different definition of an adopter than you see in the Dash 2 amendments. It adds primary bookstores for institutions of higher education to the definition of institutions of higher education. Requires the publisher to provide information under certain circumstances. And it requires that purchasers have the option of purchasing components of a bundle separately.
Okay, great. Mr. Gardner and Mr. Rowlett. Ms. Etherton, do you need to be up here as well?
Madam Chair, may I bring Mr. Hillbrand up?
Well.
And I will cede my place to him as soon as I introduce him.
Okay, introduce him and then sit back, and then I'll have the other two.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With us, Bruce Hildebrand, who is Executive Director of Higher Education for the Association of American Publishers. And before he begins his presentation, I did want to note that with regard to the Dash 3s, they do not delete the bill in its entirety. In particular, they retain the whereas clauses. Which are the recitals that are the statements of the rationale for the bill. And as I think I've expressed to each member of the committee, we do take a strong exception to those because for the reasons that are outlined in the short document that I'm going to pass out to you, we do not believe those are factually accurate. And our I don't know whether that was intentional or unintentional to retain the whereas clauses, but our Dash 2s delete those as essentially a surplusage, and we think that they have problems in terms of their factual validity. So with that, I would like to cede my place to Mr. Hillbrand.
Okay. And then Mr. Rowlett and Ms. Etherton, can you come up, please? Do the Dash 1s delete the whereas clauses?
They do not.
Okay. So Dash 1 and Dash 3 do not. Okay. You're flanked, Mr. Hildebrand. So I want to talk about the Dash 3. So... who wants to address those at the moment? And then we'll let Mr. Hildebrand talk about his Dash 2s.
Sure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is, for the record, Laura Etherton, consumer advocate with OSPIRG. And the Dash 3s are a result of conversations with representatives from the publishing industry brought forward in the last few days. They incorporate a number of the publisher's concerns as best that we were able to come to agreement around. I don't think we could describe ourselves as coming to a perfect agreement, but we wanted to make sure that we incorporated as many of the concerns as possible, and I do think the Dash 3s are an improved bill because of that. And then briefly what the Dash 3s do, they clarify the disclosure requirement. That the disclosure of the variety of textbooks should be the different versions of a particular textbook or a set of textbooks in a particular subject area. And that was clear in the original bill in the definition of the word products. But in the Dash 3s, it's actually incorporated into the actual language in the bill. In Section 2, A1, it lists it right there. So that adds, I think, some clarification. It also clarifies that the bill applies to books sold at whatever the primary bookstore of the higher education institution is, as opposed to just a bookstore that is owned by the institution. It further clarifies that the disclosure, both around the cost of the textbook and the availability of it in an unbundled format, is available, should be made available to prospective adopters of the textbook, but clarifies that that doesn't have to happen in every single time the sales representative talks to the prospective adopter. So it clarifies that piece, which is important. And then also the dash threes include the definition of adopter that the publishing companies preferred, and also further defines what a textbook bundle is, and clarifies that a textbook bundle does not include a textbook that is unusable without the supplemental course materials. So that if they really must go together in order for the textbook to be usable, we wanted to make an exception for that. And so that's what they do.
Okay. Is there a problem with the dash three? Mr. Willett, do you want to address it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Brett Rillette, Legislative Director with the Oregon Student Association. And as I was explaining to Chair Walker and to Ms. Richardson, we did have what we feel is one part of the Dash 3 that we'd like to see corrected. We're willing to do this once the bill moves to the House side. But in Section 2A, it gives the definition of the textbooks with sections B and C giving requirements. We would like to see sections B and C related to Section A, so that the requirements laid out in Section A as to what relating to a particular textbook would then be used in Section B. So, for example, in Section B, when it says the length of time publisher intends to keep each product on the market, that does not include each product in their catalog, that it would just be the particular textbook and versions of that textbook as specified in Section A. And that was... I think just inadvertently left out when they were doing the dash threes last night. But that was something we came to agreement in the past couple of days through our discussion. So that's the major change we would like to see. And then if there's any minor changes, we're willing to work with them like we have over the past few days.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Hildebrand.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Let me reiterate our exception to the whereases in the original bill that have not been excluded in the Dash 3. This was drafted by the National PIRG organization, has been used all over the country in bills that they have supported, and has been rejected in every state in which it's been offered. It is incorrect in its substance. We still support the Dash 2. This language will... We are totally for transparency. And if you put it in a context just for business reasons, our business is run in large part on the Internet. So the fact that it would be stated in any way that we do not attempt in every way possible to make this information available, it is key to the success of the larger companies in the industry. Now, the downside in any time you try to do anything sweeping is there are small firms and foreign firms who sell books into the classrooms of this country that this would probably exclude as written. And when you do that, then you cross the tripwire of the Constitution, because you're going to step on academic freedom and the ability of faculty to choose. Everybody focuses on the big guys, but there are over 4,500 publishers that are currently providing materials to the campuses across the country. Now, it has been a standard policy for years that you can order a textbook any way you want it. One of the more popular, in fact, the most popular introductory psychology book has already been sold in 169 variable bundles, and the publisher told me only last week they expect it to reach 201 variables as ordered by the faculty. Now, what we have done is work through here some definitions that clarify in Dash 2 what actually is a bundle, because there are exclusions that are included in that. For example, a custom book, which is the fastest growing segment of the public college publishing industry, that are not specifically excluded. And we can't tell you what a custom book is, because it is designed only upon faculty's request to their specifications. So we can't stipulate it. And it has to be included, cannot be excluded. A special edition. I was asked yesterday, what is a special edition? There are discussions going on at Virginia Tech right now about a special edition that would honor the students and have some of their writings and other things incorporated into a book. This does not fall into the normal textbook category. But if this were some terrible, tragic incident like this were to happen in Oregon, according to this bill, that book could not be published and sold on a campus. So it cannot be excluded. The other things that we thought, this bill as written by the students will not lower the cost of textbooks or student spending. You cannot attempt to actually lower costs because then that puts you in the state to being at the point of price controls. Our goals are to lower student spending. And by if you would include that, particularly this thing about limiting the sale, purchase and sale of preview copies that are delivered for free, it will have a profound effect on the industry. And I think that's what we need to look to. We should not be looking for means to complicate this thing and add costs, but for looking for ways that constitutionally will simplify and hopefully reduce student spending. And that's our goal, and that's why we are endorsing Dash 2.
Okay. Ms. Etherton and Mr. Rowlett, do you want to respond to some of the statements made here?
Sure.
Could you first address the first one? That they have an exception to the whereas clauses. They've not been accepted in any state that the national programs have brought forward. Could you address that one, please?
Chair Walker and members of the committee. The whereas clauses are, we believe, simply helpful background regarding the problems that actual students, the actual faculty, are experiencing on college campuses here in Oregon and around the nation. In this committee, you've heard from a number of those students and faculty members who are experiencing these problems. The textbooks, according to the GAO report, textbooks and supplies together are a significant college cost, amounting to about 26% of the cost of tuition. What we've found here in Oregon is that it's nearly 20% of the college costs at a four-year university, more or less, for most the students who take the most commonly taken classes.
Chair, just a clarification, if I could. You said that the statistics show that textbooks and supplies, that includes a whole lot more than just textbooks. So I would suggest that the 26% is not accurate just based on that, but the whereas says just textbooks.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, the Oregon Student Association did a scientific study of students in Oregon, and it backs up the PERG data when it comes to how much students in Oregon are spending on textbooks. I don't want to spend too much time debating whereas clauses because I think we feel the most important part is the bill and what it does for students and faculty, but our survey data has shown that the average student in Oregon spending approximately $945 a year on textbooks, and this was a report that was released last month with very current scientific data. So in regards to that part of the whereas clause, it does, and that survey looks solely at the cost of textbooks, not including supplies.
Okay. Ms. Etherton, can you answer the question more directly, though? Has bills similar to this have been offered in other states? Have other states adopted this bill language, including the whereas clauses?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that California has adopted language similar to the whereas clauses. I do not know if it was exact in any way. The most recent bills, I believe, have passed in Washington, most recently with the governor signing a disclosure piece around textbooks. But in terms of the exact language of the whereas clauses, I'm not sure if that exact language has passed in other states.
Well, the whereas clauses, the exact language is not going to keep me from supporting this bill. If that's something you want to work with the textbook manufacturers on in the future to refine, that's great. But we've had this bill for quite a while. It was introduced in January. Actually, it was pre-session filed. So it's been here for quite some time. Any other comments that you wanted to make, Ms. Otherton?
Well, I wanted to
Talk about the special edition issue that's been raised, the example of the Virginia Tech students.
Sure. In the Dash 3s, there is nothing in the Dash 3s that would prevent a special edition from being offered to students. It simply requires that if there is a textbook bundle where there's a textbook and other materials, a CD-ROM, workbook, that the adopters, the faculty members, when choosing what textbooks to use, they have the option to order just the textbook or the textbook and the supplemental materials, depending on how they are deciding themselves to teach that course. And so there's nothing in the bill that prohibits bundled materials from being sold. It simply puts that decision in the hands of the faculty members who are designing the course and gives them more information about the availability of that.
And you've corrected the problem before where if the bundled piece is necessary to the book and can't be sold separately, you're still allowing that under this.
And I'm sure that's exactly right. The publishers did bring up, I think, a good point, that there are times when, for example, a textbook that actually explains is instruction for how to use a computer program,
right,
sold with the computer program, the textbook really isn't usable. It doesn't make sense without that CD.
Okay.
We absolutely want to acknowledge those times when that makes sense, and we're happy to continue working to refine the details of the bill. But I think that the Dash 3s represent a lot of coming together between us and the publishers. We're disappointed that we're not able to come to a perfect agreement, but I think this is a good common sense bill that brings basic disclosure and basic options for faculty who want to order the textbook apart from all the supplemental materials that we've heard here in Oregon from faculty and from students are a problem that are resulting in driving up costs.
Questions, Senator Morse? Do you look like you wanted to vote?
Thank you. And I can appreciate the dilemma of students. You know, we don't fund education adequately and puts even more pressure on students that have to pay, you know, the textbooks and the textbook cost. But I'm really at a loss as to what this bill will do. You know, my staff, policy advisor Ed Wright, has a doctorate in education and mathematics. He's written two textbooks. He's collaborated on a third. He spent his entire career in education, in higher education. And I asked him if he would, and he's been retired for a few years, but I asked him if he would go and see if you can buy unbundled and if price is readily disclosed. And he did. I'm wondering what this bill actually accomplishes if you're wanting to reduce cost, because it appears that professors can buy unbundled and that price is readily disclosed. Now, he went to Wadsworth Publishing, list the price, you know, it's available, went to Prentice Hall. And help me understand how this bill lowers your costs for students.
Well, I think that, Madam Chair and Senator Morse, that the reality of many faculty's experience in ordering textbooks when they are working with publishers' representatives, when they're navigating the different websites, they report having difficulty finding what price that book is available at, and And also that a number of times the bundled, unbundled version of the textbook is either not available or it's incredibly difficult for them to figure out if it's available unbundled. So what this bill does is, I think, some very simple pieces that are straightforward, just clarifying that what is appropriate is, in fact, what I think is happening in some cases, clear disclosure of the price, of the amount of time that the publisher intends to keep that product on the market, and what the different versions of that textbook are, if there are lower cost versions, being upfront about that, and being upfront about the fact whether or not that textbook is available in an unbundled version, to the extent that many of them are available in an unbundled version. Our research has found that many of them are not. More than half of the books that we surveyed in a recent survey of the bundled textbooks were not available in an unbundled format.
Senator Cruz, were you done, Senator Morris?
Well, I'm at a loss. Could you comment on the dash twos? It does have a price disclosure requirement.
Well, I know, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, if I could just add to, I guess first to the first question, we see this bill, well, some of the publishing companies are up front. There are definitely companies out there that are not providing all of the information that instructors would like to see. In a meeting with the chancellor of the university system where we discussed this bill, and he did not know the price of the textbook that he was going to require for his students until he bought it himself. And he actually had to buy it because he wasn't able to receive a free one because he's the chancellor of the system. But the only way for him to actually find the price was by purchasing the book. And
excuse me, you mean he couldn't have, you know, the chancellor isn't going to necessarily know the price of every book in every course in the university. So he couldn't have asked somebody for the price?
The Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's exactly what this bill would do, would be to provide the information to the instructors so that they have all the materials necessary to make the choices, what's best for their class, what's best for students.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, the chancellor isn't a good example here. The course instructors would be the good examples of whether they knew the price of what they were looking at for their courses. And that's the chancellor's at a higher level than knowing every textbook in every class, I would think.
Well, and Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, we see the exact same thing with instructors. We've had the instructors here testifying. The bill's been endorsed by faculty unions because the faculty would like to see this. And we don't believe that this will increase cost for students. We believe it would be the exact opposite. By letting faculty know what options are available for their class and that they have the ability to purchase just the materials that are related, they wouldn't have to they wouldn't have students purchasing unnecessary workbooks, CDs that are bundled together. And when you eliminate the excess waste that's unnecessary for the class, students will save money. And so that's, and we also believe that you're providing more options for professors. Not only do they just have one bundle, they have the different ways you can put that bundle together. If you just need the book with a workbook and not with the CD, that's an option.
Mr. Rollett, didn't you say in your example with the chancellor that the chancellor was teaching a class and so he had to buy the book?
Correct. Madam Chair, he does teach a class at Portland State University.
Okay, there you go, Senator.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could ask an additional question. Mm-hmm. So an instructor wants a book for his class. And let's say the book has a CD-ROM and several supplements depending upon the direction he wants the class to take. That's fairly standard. And you're telling me that some instructors are being told they can't buy the book with supplement A and B and nothing else, that they're being told that they have to buy the whole package?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's been the testimony of some of the faculty members. They do not always have the options to purchase unbundled. While some distributors are very upfront and provide that opportunity, others do not. And so all we're trying to do is make this as transparent as possible, provide the instructors with all the options, give them all the information possible, just like you would like to have if you went and purchased an automobile or anything else on the market. You want to know how much each little part of it will cost you so you can decide what's best for yourself. And so that's what we hope to do with this bill. In regards to the question concerning the Dash 2 amendments, that was proposed by the publishing representatives, and we did work off that. We included some of that language in the Dash 3, but we did have some concerns with some of the sections that were added to the Dash 2, which were completely separate from what we were intending to get done with the bill in its original format, and that deals with the ethics side of it. And we feel that if that's a necessary bill, that should be brought up separately. That was not something that we've done research in, not something we've talked to faculty about. And so that was, there's two sections in the Dash 2 that we were very concerned with.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up, just because I'm trying to get a sense of this from a business perspective, and you brought up the concept of a car, and if I'm going into a Chevy dealer to look at a Chevy, and he's saying, here's the car, these are the options that are on it, these are the additional options you can buy, he's going to know full well if I say, well, I'd like the car, but I don't want these things, I don't want to pay for them, he knows full well that if he tells me you have no choice, you have to buy them with those options, he knows full well I'm going to go over across the street to the Ford dealer and get the car with the options I want. So I'm trying to understand how this works in a competitive environment, because there are many manufacturers of textbooks selling basically in the same subject area. And so I just have a hard time understanding that somebody trying to sell a book is going to say, I'm not going to sell you the book unless you take all the pieces, because there's a profit in selling just the basic book.
Sure.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, it's a very good question, and I think we have been, faculty and students ask themselves that same question all the time. How can we get the textbooks that we need for that have the educational material that we want, and not have all this extra material and have good disclosure? The textbook industry is a little different than some others in that the faculty member or the adopting committee who decides what book to order is different than the person that ultimately pays the price. And so it's a little bit different, and there is a little bit of a gap there. I think the goal with this bill is to, as in any other market, to bring disclosure of cost and disclosure of the variety of products that are available in a particular subject area or for a particular textbook to help the market work better, to bring that added disclosure in. And I think what we're seeing is that faculty and students are concerned about the lack of disclosure and concerned about the lack of options regarding bundled versus unbundled that's happening across the industry, and would need this additional disclosure and choices.
Okay. I'm going to go with Senator Morris now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Dash 2s address exactly the concerns that you've raised. Says any publisher shall offer the option of buying each component of the textbook bundle separately, and then it says any publisher shall, upon request, make available the price at which the publisher would make the components of the textbook bundle available. Doesn't that address both of the issues that you're concerned about?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I think it gets very close. Our only concern was paragraph 2 of Section 2, the disclosure is only upon request, and we believe that the upfront disclosure of cost is important as well, that be available to prospective adopters of the textbooks and broadly available. And so that it would only be available upon request as opposed to an upfront disclosure, I think is the problem there. And then we don't have any problem with Section 2 sub 1. The sort of the wrinkle is in the definition of textbook bundle in the Dash 2s that we believe have some components that may unintentionally open up a loophole to publishers being able to declare books either custom editions or special editions, or that they would be declare that they're an integrated combination. If the textbook, for example, ever refers to an exercise done in a CD-ROM that could be attached, if they're integrated but not necessarily having to go together, if the text could still be used without the CD-ROM, for example, we think that this may create a loophole where that the options of bundling would be curtailed. And so those were the areas there that we had concerns with. But those same pieces are included in the dash threes as well. It's the difference is that in the disclosure piece that it would require upfront disclosure and not just disclosure upon request of the faculty member.
Senator Morsi, concluded in your question.
Well, I'm kind of confused as to what we accomplished to lower the cost to students.
Okay.
That's where this whole thing escapes me.
All right. Senator Metzger?
I move the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 365.
Senator Metzger moves the dash three amendment to Senate Bill 365. Any further discussion that we haven't already had?
Thank you for not calling on Senator Cruz.
But that was the look of, I just seen you didn't, so I won't.
All right. Let's take the roll on the dash three.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
No.
Senator Wesley?
Aye.
Senator
Cruz? No.
Chair Walker?
Aye. The dash three is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 365 is amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Metzger moves Senate Bill 365 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further comments?
I do.
Yes, Senator Metzger.
Just one final one. I think that I agree with Senator Morris. There's some confusion here as to what we're accomplishing, but I think that I think there is agreement that we want to make sure that materials are available. We want to make sure they're cost-effective. We want to make sure that there's transparency. And the reality is we have a choice as to continue to work on this and try and hone it better so that we all can agree that we're accomplishing a result. Or we let it set aside. And I think my preference, knowing how things are working, continuing to work on this gives us another month to continue to work on this issue, and I think it's valuable enough to continue the process. I will support it.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I, it's not that I am unsympathetic to the issue and wanting to see a good resolution. It's just that I think that the Dash 2 amendment brings us much closer to a clean bill with no... the whereases have some great concern for me, but I would think that in either the threes or the twos, basically what I'm hearing from the folks at the table is they're getting really close both ways, mm-hmm. to some agreement. I would prefer the twos because they're a cleaner version of the bill.
Okay. You know, I agree with you. I think they're getting close. It's unfortunate that Mr. Hildebrand waited until the final days of our ability to get a Senate bill out to come out and have this conversation with these students and these folks who are interested in this bill. So, that's partly the problem here. I'm not letting this bill die, and I'm not sending it over to the interim. And so I would just encourage you, Mr. Hildebrand, if you're still concerned about this bill, to stick around and have some further conversations with these folks and change it in the House.
Madam Chair, we never expected to come through your LC because of the original bill had not been filtered through any other LC in the country. So we were really shocked when it came out. That's why we had waited, anticipating it would not come out as written. And when it did, it was very late, and I flew here immediately. That was the big delay. We really didn't ever expect it to come out of your legislative council for constitutional reasons.
Well, we didn't seem to have those constitutional reasons, and we did have a hearing on this bill earlier this month. And
I believe we testified in Mr. Jim.
Yeah, we had testimony earlier this month. All right, any further comments? Okay, Ms. Gravel, would you take the roll, please?
Senator Metzger? Aye.
No.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Chair
Walker? Aye. Senate Bill 365 will move to the floor of the Senate, and I will ask Senator Morissette to carry this one with me. Okay, everybody else got off the hook today. All right, colleagues, are we in recess until 6 p.m.? Is that the official?
I think we just adjourn, and then we have another hearing at 6 p.m.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
On the last bill we had, I'd serve notice of potential minority report.
Well, there you go. I was waiting for one of those. Your notice has been noted. And
let's make clear that we're carrying over 378.
Okay, we are carrying over. I just want to make clear we're carrying over 378 to this evening while we get some small fix to that.
But the rest of the time it's going to be there.
The rest of the time it is the Metolius. We are scheduled to go until 8, colleagues. But I want you to know it may take a little bit longer, so just I'll try not to keep you too much past time. But please make sure you have your dinner beforehand.
We just held
1029. I'm going to write a letter, and we're going to do a letter instead. Remember that? Okay.
A
softer approach with a big stick in the background.
Never gotten a stick.
She speaks. Her voice is very gentle, but it has some bite to it.
Because I do know how to use the gut and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anything else, committee? Thank you for your attention. We'll adjourn until 6 p.m.